Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and go with me here. I've got a question. Are legal, constitutional, civil rights a given? Everyone gets them. No one can take them away. No one can earn points and get more rights. Do we agree on that? People have rights. That's the basic tenet of the U.S. Constitution. But who are people? Corporations are people, we understand. What about people in the military? Do their sacrifices constitute extra credit? Do they get more rights? And how about people behind bars? Is the Constitution suspended for them? Well, while you're thinking about that, let me say that we will hear the amazing story of a veteran from Iraq and Afghanistan later this hour. We will also note some lawmakers in California who have a very creative notion of water rights when it comes to their own lawns in the middle of a drought. And we will get an update on the debate over public health measures to deal with the Ebola crisis. But we begin this hour with the Supreme Court, where today the nine justices will hear the case of Holt versus Hobbs. It involves religion, prisoners' rights, and a beard. Gregory Holt is serving a life sentence for domestic battery and burglary in the Arkansas State Prison. Holt, also known as Abdul Malik Muhammad, converted to Islam. He filed a handwritten petition to the Supreme Court challenging an Arkansas policy that denies prisoners the right to grow a beard. Holt says his religion requires him to grow a half-inch long beard. Arkansas prison officials argue that their policy is necessary for prison safety. Joining us is Sarah Baringer Gordon, a professor of law, history, and religion at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
So I know there's a legal issue here, but there's just something that sounds trivial about this case. Assure me that that is not the case.
That really isn't the case, especially in a country with as large a prison population as the United States, and with questions of religious observance. One of the few liberties that prisoners retain when incarcerated.
And the question of Islam and a beard, is there an exclusion for religious practices that involve outward physical behaviors of one kind or another? I mean, I guess growing a beard is an outward physical attribute that might be different from reading the Bible, but I still don't see how it threatens safety in a prison.
Indeed. These are excellent questions, and similar debates have swirled around for a generation and more. Native American prisoners asking to grow braids, for example, religious prisoners asking to grow beards. What prisons argue, especially with very full beards, the beard in question here would be 1/2 inch long, so not a terribly full beard. But they argue that weapons, drugs, or so on could be concealed in the beard, and that if a prisoner escaped, all he would have to do would be to shave to look very different. On the other hand, 43 states have allowed half-inch beards. So it's not the case that prison officials all agree that this is such a dire threat. I should also mention that the prison does allow prisoners who have dermatological issues, ingrown hair and so on, where shaving would be very painful, does allow them already to grow beards.
In general terms here, and getting away from this Holt case, has the Supreme Court ever ruled that obedience in a prison setting or following rules on private property or following rules in a corporate setting is equivalent to giving up your rights as a citizen constitutionally?
Certainly they have. And the question is whether this is one of those situations. There was actually a case in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers where I live, Philadelphia, but also New Jersey, written by now Justice Alito, who then was a Third Circuit judge, involving the Newark police force and a Muslim police officer asked to be able to grow a beard, and the police chief said no. And a very similar situation, the police allowed men with dermatological issues to grow beards, but not Muslim officers. And then judge and now Justice Alito wrote for a unanimous Third Circuit saying that violated his free exercise rights, that even the interest in uniformity among police officers shouldn't overrule the situation. And with military, police, prison, there are, of course, more interest in obedience, uniformity, and so on. But even there, courts have found that beards and modest beards in such situations generally are not a dire security threat.
Where would you say the courts are and the judiciary is in the United States regarding the question of whether the state can trump constitutional rights on the basis of security? I mean, the Patriot Act would suggest that, yes, security trumps the Constitution on some level. But this case and some of the rulings that you've cited suggest, no, that uniformity and questions of being a part of the military doesn't trump the constitutional rights that we're all given.
You're absolutely right. The law pulls in two directions. One of the interesting things about this case is that it involves a statute called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act of 2000, which especially is targeted at those who are institutionalized, that is, incarcerated or otherwise hospitalized and so on. In return for federal funding, states are required not to infringe, not to burden the religious freedom of those institutionalized persons without a compelling state interest and in the least restrictive means possible. So Congress has sent a message to the courts and the states that they're very interested in the religious rights of those who are confined in narrow spaces.
Well, we'll see how that tension plays out in the arguments today in the case before the Supreme Court. Holt versus Hobbs. Sarah Beringer Gordon is a professor of law, history, and religion at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In terms of fear alone, the Ebola virus is as menacing as any of the infectious diseases. The top story in Spain today, for instance, is the report that a single Spanish nurse is the first person to contract Ebola outside of West Africa. She was treating Spanish missionary priests from Africa who later died. Hospital staff blame a failure of protective clothing, while investigators say they are still looking for what, if anything, went wrong. The Ebola death toll is now at more than 3,400, with an estimated 7,500 active infection cases, although thousands may still be infected who have not reported to any medical clinic. Some of those may be in the city of Dallas. I say maybe, where there remains uncertainty surrounding who the infected man Thomas Duncan, clinging to life now in a hospital in Dallas, came in contact with when he arrived in the U.S. from Liberia. To figure this out and to give us some clarity here, Dr. Helene Gale joins us. She worked with the Centers for Disease Control for 20 years. She started as an epidemic intelligence officer with a special focus on HIV/AIDS, worked with a number of different positions with the CDC, and is now president and CEO of CARE, a humanitarian aid organization. Helene Gale, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So, Dr. Gale, let's describe what's going on in, say, a place like Spain, where all of a sudden there's this single case and everyone springs into action. Do you see normal protocols in Spain? And thinking about Dallas, is it more of a chaotic situation down there?
Well, I think all of the places in countries like Spain and the United States have really sprung to action very quickly to make sure that we're putting our best medical services in place to make sure we're detecting and isolating anybody who might have been in contact with people who have Ebola. I think, you know, the real contrast is between what's going on in countries where the epidemic is having a huge impact, where the infrastructure and the health services are not at the same standard as what we have here.
Thinking about Dallas for just a moment, do you think that the U.S. was sufficiently prepared for this infection, in the sense that how concerned are you about the inability of local organizations to get waivers or permits to transmit contaminated materials from Thomas Duncan's or the apartment that Thomas Duncan was staying at, because that required a different jurisdiction to be involved? Wouldn't you expect there would be waivers in an instance like this because it is something of an emergency?
Well, we should be able to spring to action and look at how to have an integrated response. Unfortunately, something like this that was somewhat unexpected does challenge our ability to work together and pull the different parts of the system that are necessary. It sounds like, and I'm not immediately involved in that situation, but it sounds like they are trying to cut through some of the red tape and make sure that the different parts of the system are working together so that the rest of the population can be assured that they are not going to have exposure.
Are transportation networks a real wild card or a wrench thrown into the works here for someone who tries to control epidemics as you do, Dr. Gale?
Well, you know, people are contagious generally when they're symptomatic, and there are good protocols in place to check the main symptoms like elevated temperature to give a sense of whether or not people who are traveling are actually potentially symptomatic and potentially contagious. So I think the protocols that are in place should make travel and other things safe for most people. So in health and particularly in public health, sad but true, there is no 100% guarantee. And I think we have to put in place the things that will protect the most people most of the time. And I think we've done a good job of putting in place those kinds of precautions and those kinds of systems so that somebody who is symptomatic and therefore contagious would not be getting on a plane and would not be in a situation to continue to spread the Ebola virus.
Dr. Helene Gale is a 20-year veteran at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She's now the president and CEO of CARE, a leading humanitarian aid organization. Dr. Gale, thanks so much.
My pleasure, John.
Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are seizing the opportunity to respond to the Ebola crisis, and Charles Schumer, senior senator from New York, has proposed tightening regulations and monitoring of transportation networks to vastly reduce the chance of an infected person getting through undetected. He says he's hoping eventually for White House support.
What we've recommended be done in America is two things. When people who have come from one of the hotspots, Ebola hotspots in West Africa, come to America, one, they ought to take their temperature. Now, they're doing that in the West African Ebola hotspots, but it may not be reliable. And if they develop the symptoms during the flight, we would have a better chance of catching them. But more importantly, we ask that they do extensive screening. In other words, the CDC is very good at sitting down with someone and going through a list of all the people they've seen, what they've met. They may not realize they've been in contact with the Ebola virus, or they may be deceptive about it. And if in Africa they simply ask them, have you contacted anyone with Ebola, they might say no, either because they want to come or they're not sure they did. But if you ask them a whole series of questions and you do it here in the United States, they're more likely to be truthful. What made me decide that this was the right thing to do was that one person with Ebola came into Dallas and the whole area was sort of paralyzed and almost panicked. And I want to underscore, panic is not necessary here. The CDC does a very good job. But when it comes to something like Ebola, both because it's such a horrible disease and hard to cure disease once you have it, and because it's spreading such fear, you can't be too careful. An extra layer of precaution makes sense. 2 days ago, Mr. Frieden, and yesterday, the president said they're considering doing additional things at airports, and this is what we think they should do.
Given that in Dallas, an individual by the name of Thomas Duncan voluntarily turned himself in twice to a hospital, and the result was the panic that you describe, to do this in a systematic way to virtually everyone who comes in from Liberia and Sierra Leone who is visiting a hotspot, aren't you just transferring the panic from a small neighborhood in Dallas to an entire airport and four airports around the United States?
No, because what really made people panic is someone who had Ebola was traveling throughout Dallas. If you can find anyone who might have Ebola at the airport and properly deal with them, isolate them, make sure they don't get in contact with other people, that's how you stop Ebola from spreading.
You would not advocate a ban on travel from Liberia and Sierra Leone?
No, see, this is the middle ground. Some have called for a ban on travel. The experts all tell us that would be counterproductive. Not a single expert has said that what we've proposed would be counterproductive. They all agree it would help. The question is how much it would help and how much it would cost. And the way we weigh it, given that it's a small number of people who come from the Ebola hotspots to the United States, given that it would be at a limited number of airports that already take care of international travelers, that the costs are rather small and the benefit is significant.
Senior Senator from the state of New York, Senator Chuck Schumer, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Fighting the state of emergency drought in the state of California is supposed to be a team effort. We're all in this together is the message here.
Breaking up with your lawn can be hard to do, but when you're in a serious drought, the timing couldn't be better. Be California friendly. Replace thirsty grass with California friendly plants and save hundreds of gallons a week, while boosting your curb appeal. You'll wonder why you waited so long.
But there are fines of $500 a day for residents not being team players and found wasting water illegally, watering plants or washing cars. But some California lawmakers leading the charge to regulate residential water use, according to the Center for Investigative Reporting, are actually big water wasters in their own backyards. Lance Williams is a senior reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting. He says state citizens are once again getting soaked.
Many of them are profligate water users, John. They ignore the very regulations they're promoting. We found that of the top water agencies in the state, we found that 60% of the officials used more water in 2013 than they did in 2012. That's as the drought is worsening and as the encouragement to cut back is ratcheting up. And some of these guys use so much water, it's a little silly. We have them using as much as would supply 8 families. That's just to take care of their lush landscaping in their desert communities.
What kinds of things did you stumble on? What, you know, little fountains, little, you know, sprinkler systems? What sort of ridiculous landscaping did you find here?
I'm thinking of the Riverside City Councilman who used 1 million gallons a year, 2 years in a row. He has an acre-plus property on a windswept hilltop 50 miles east of Los Angeles, and the landscaping looks like something you'd see in Bayou Country, a spreading willow tree, flowering shrubs, beautiful lush green grass. I mean, it's nice, but the natural setting down there, especially in August, September, in a dry year, it's like a desert, and that's what it wants to be, and only by putting way more water on it than you're supposed to be allowed does it exist.
So you're describing the lush and tranquil home setting of Riverside City Councilman Mike Subaru?
That's true. And he just doesn't know how he's going to use less water up there.
I live in an area where the wind kind of comes up and it dries out my yard very quickly. So do I just, you know, abandon my yard and devalue my property? I don't know.
So his answer to you was, what do you want me to do, let all these plants die?
Yes. And, of course, that is what ordinary Californians are being encouraged to do and prodded to do by the water agencies. You're supposed to rip out your yard or let it go to seed and put in drought-tolerant plants, something that can exist in a Mediterranean climate.
And any remorse here, any contrition on the part of officials who you had these discussions with?
Well, there's a councilman in Fresno out in the Central Valley who the first year he had a water meter, used 1 million gallons of water. Again, that's about enough for 8 families. He was contrite. His name is Oliver Baines, and he described a sort of a nightmare scenario with his sprinklers.
I apologize. You know, clearly I am not a model of water usage, and I'm sorry for that.
What was the context of that remark from Councilman Oliver Baines?
His sprinklers were going on in the middle of the night, and he wasn't aware that the sprinkler heads were broken and they were pumping, just flooding his backyard so much that he had a sinkhole, and yet he didn't really suspect that there was an issue or problem, and it went on for months and months and months until he finally got it straightened out. Fresno in the valley didn't have water meters till last year, and they boast of having the cheapest residential water rates in the state. And so for a guy with a new meter who's only paying like $150 even when he's flooding his yard, perhaps you wouldn't notice. But again, Fresno's another city that's leaning on ordinary ratepayers to cut back.
And the water in Fresno, where does it come from? It's not the rain.
It's a runoff from the Sierras, the great system of aquifers that supplies both agriculture and cities in the North State, and they also draw from wells.
And Fresno is upstream from virtually everybody else in the state as far as Sierra runoff is concerned, right? They get it first.
I guess that's right. The San Joaquin River runs right past their door.
And so it's a little hypocritical. I mean, it's more than a little hypocritical for him to say, oh, gosh, I just didn't notice that my sprinklers went on in the night.
He probably had other issues. I think that's what we find with these water officials, that it doesn't necessarily seem to be topic A at their personal residence.
Part of this is the story of how a drought works. I mean, some people see it as absolutely urgent and other people don't see it as absolutely urgent. And it's hard for everyone to get on the same page. Without forgiving any of these officials that you talk to, how difficult is this drought in terms of getting everyone to be, together, a team effort on all this?
Well, since so many of the drought reduction efforts are voluntary or the penalties are often waived by the agencies, it's more, cajoling people. And I suppose it's somewhat effective. If it doesn't rain, they're going to have to do something a little more serious, though. I think that an effective means would be to just ratchet the rates up for these guys so that it becomes prohibitive.
In environmental terms, is it the case that if these individuals, these profligate water users, were to actually conserve, it wouldn't affect the drought in any way? It's more a matter of just solidarity with the people.
Yeah, it's practicing what you preach. What credibility do you have telling some poor guy not to wash his car for 6 weeks when you're sprinkling every night so that the water's running down the street? I mean, it just it's hard to make the message stick that it's a serious problem when your personal behavior is like that.
How's the willow tree in your backyard, Lance?
Got a redwood tree. I got two oak trees, and I don't irrigate them. They just do what they can.
Lance Williams is a senior reporter focusing on money and politics at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Lance, thanks so much.
John, thank you.
And for those of you in the arid West, how has this historic drought changed your life? What measures are you taking to preserve water or change your lifestyle? Let us know. Visit us at facebook.com/thetakeaway or just find us at Twitter. We are at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. It uses no water.
Stops the quarterback. They put him in motion. They get him. Appreciation Day, a man who has served in the military and been injured.
Touchdown for the Clemson Tigers a little less than a year ago. A lopsided game. The Tigers won 52-6 over Citadel, but the man crossing the goal line on a 2-yard run was ending a journey much longer than the length of a football field. 26-year-old Daniel Rodriguez's journey began when he enlisted in the Army right out of high school, served in Iraq and Afghanistan, wounded, witness to the deaths of 24 fellow soldiers. He made it home after some of the bloodiest fighting of the Afghan War, the Battle of Kamdesh. His dream after his harrowing combat tour? To play college football, to try and find a normal life and tell his story. Daniel Rodriguez is living that dream, telling his story in the book Rise, an epic story of a soldier, his dream, and a promise kept. He says while a football field is often compared to a battlefield, he would never confuse them.
In football, you can see the opponent or the enemy, if you will, coming at you. You're bound to get hit, whereas in combat, you can't see that bullet or that incoming round, where I think luck has a little bit more to do than football does. But, definitely was lucky on the battlefield to be where I am today.
You chose to be a Division I athlete, and you chose to go back to school. But it was sort of less of a choice after high school.
Correct.
After all you went through to go into the Army, right?
Correct. For me, 4 days after I graduated high school, my father passed away suddenly. And it was at that moment where I really needed to define my life. And I didn't want to be that kid that made excuses around his hometown and was the guy that never made it out. So I just went and enlisted in the military right out of high school, didn't tell anybody, just went and did it. And it was kind of making those choices that really put me in the position of warfare and all that came along with the military. So through all that, really instilled a lot into me of what I wanted to become once I got out, and that's kind of where I am today.
So many Americans have, lived with these wars. In Afghanistan since 01, in Iraq since 03, and are looking for a good, positive story. Do you think people found you, or you sort of found the people who want to tell your story? Because there aren't a lot of great positive stories coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan.
I agree. I completely agree with you. There's so much attention on the negativity of what war does, and it's true. I mean, if you looked at it on a scale, I'm sure the bad does outweigh the good, but I felt that I've accomplished in the name of so many that have given their lives, because that's ultimately my motivation, is the buddies that have been killed, that I've known. I want to make sure my life isn't pointless. I want to make sure my life represents their losses in a positive way, that if this becomes a good story out of the conflicts of Iraq and Afghanistan, then I'll bear that crown with all the pride in the world, because I know that what my friends did is ultimately the reason why I'm here. So,
Who did you lose?
I've lost 24 friends in both conflicts, but more recently, on October 3rd, 2009, I was involved in the Battle of Kamdesh, where 8 Americans were killed, and those 8 were very close to me.
How did they go? What happened?
It was an 18-hour firefight. There was 39 Americans. We were overrun by 400-plus Taliban. They were inside our wire. We were killing at point blank. We had about 125 in and around the wire dead by the end of the day. 8 Americans were killed, mostly all by sniper fire. I was wounded in the legs. I had some shrapnel in my neck and a bullet fragment through my shoulder. The 22 of us were wounded, so I was one of 22 to receive a Purple Heart. 8 were killed, and there was only a handful that weren't even touched. But after that day, just seeing what they had gone through and knowing what I had survived, I just knew that I couldn't be content living something mediocre, and I had to do more, and I had to fulfill what I set out to do, making a promise to my friend that I was going to try to play football somewhere.
A lot of soldiers have come back from Iraq and Afghanistan say two things. One, they can't stand being asked, you know, did you kill anyone? How did you kill anyone? Who did
Absolutely.
You kill? That sort of thing. The other thing they say is that they get really emotional about those sort of halftime moments mm-hmm. at the sporting events where everybody goes, oh, wow,
yeah.
thanks for your service, and then goes back to their lives.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about those two things?
I agree. You know, it's a tough question to be asked, have you killed anybody or did you kill anybody, you know? And it's not that I'm ashamed of saying, yes, I've killed somebody. It's more or less recalling the incident of doing it. You know, so it's something that I don't brag on. You know, it was a kill or be killed situation. I have a family that I wanted to see again and friends that I wanted to see again. So when my life was on the line, I did what I had to do. And I sleep just at fine at night doing it. But on the other hand, with the other side of that, these halftime ceremonies you get, I was so bitter when I came home from war. I really was, you know, because I knew what I had gone through. I knew the friends that had suffered, the friends that came home and committed suicide because of what they had seen. And people are giving, you know, the Army band a standing ovation for their service. And you're like, as an adolescent coming home from war, I'm like, what the hell did they do on the battlefield? I've got friends that are buried in Arlington National Cemetery, and you're giving, you know, a trumpet player the same standing ovation that my friends died for. And you really don't make the connection, and you have to really humble yourself and realize that I put myself in that situation. I put myself enlisting in an infantry army during a time of war. So it's very selfish and irresponsible for me to point fingers and look at things so negatively when I ultimately predicted the lifestyle that I ended up living in the military. So it was tough, though, when I came home having the sentimental 10 minutes of respect at halftime, and then people go about their daily lives, because you really just think of it as a, do these people really even give a crap about what I did? And that's a question you live with. But at the end of the day, you know, I
ultimately... Do you know an answer to that?
Maybe not, to be honest with you. You know, like, I know when I first came home and it was in a very different mental state than I am now, and people would say, thank you for, you know, protecting my freedom. And I'd want to respond, was your freedom really in jeopardy? Was it, you know, was your home
right.
front... Is there any concept of what you know that I went through? And it's very valid. And I don't think people necessarily need to know what I've gone through to give a crap about it, as long as maybe they do have some kind of respect, knowing, you know, just knowing what we go through for them. And for me, knowing that some people care in that aspect is just as good as them knowing what I'd gone through.
Why do you think you didn't go down that dark road that so many soldiers have gone down, killed themselves, you know, got involved in drugs.
Absolutely.
And abuse. And
it was around me. You know, my friends yeah. were doing it. And I honestly, it's just the way I was thinking. You know, I went through a time where I was listening to myself instead of talking to myself, making excuses. My father passed away. My grades weren't any good. I've lost this many friends in combat. You know, I've been wounded. The VA owes me. You know, I need disability.
That gave you an excuse to
gave
do
me
bad
an excuse.
Stuff.
And as soon as you start thinking the right way and realizing that you still are in control of your destiny by your actions and the way you think, you become such a different person. And
what was the turnaround for you? What was the turnaround?
The turnaround, honestly, was just having a gun in my mouth and realizing that this wasn't the way I wanted to go. And you really come to the fork in the road where it's like, is my life really going to be defined? What I did, seeing my buddies die, come home so somebody can find me on a kitchen table with a note written? You know what I mean? Is that really what my life is going to boil down to, everything that I put so much hard work into?
You thought that?
Absolutely.
With the gun in your mouth?
With the gun in my mouth. I did not know what my purpose was in this life, what I was here for, why I survived and my friends didn't, why I didn't do enough to get my friends home. There's so much thought and negativity that went through my head because I felt I didn't do enough on the battlefield. No matter how many men I killed, I came home and my friends didn't. That is something that you have to live with and sleep with and deal with for the rest of your life and see mothers and loved ones and children that'll never see their father again, and you were the last human being seeing them bleed out. That's something that's difficult. That's PTSD. That's what messes with you. And for me, the turning point was I could either take my own life or I could actually live my life in a way that honors them that gave their life. Mm. And I felt it was more of a road that I felt that I could do and live through and go about and keep my head high if I lived in their name and made sure I didn't do anything or I wasn't complacent with my life, making sure that I was doing more for their name instead of mine.
Daniel Rodriguez is the author of Rise, an epic story of a soldier, his dream, and a promise kept. He's a wide receiver on Clemson University's football team. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. You can also find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.